We're now at Book 1, Chapter 11, the third part, the very famous and difficult to make sense out of Digression on Silver. The formal title of the section is Digression Concerning the Variations in the Value of Silver During the Course of the Four Last Centuries, but people generally just call it Digression on Silver. I should note, it's very hard to make sense out of this section. It's long, it's sprawling, it's diverse, it doesn't have a clearly concentrated message, so I'm going to do my best to try to pull out some common threads from the Digression on Silver, but keep in mind, it's a digression. That's why it's called Digression on Silver. I read this section with an overriding question in mind, or what I thought Smith had in mind, and that is, which relative price shifts accompany prosperity? That is, as an economy grows, what do we know about which prices are likely to go up in relative terms and which prices are likely to go down? If anything, I think that's the organizing question here. An undercurrent in the Digression of Silver is Smith's overall philosophy of history. So Smith is writing at a time when a lot of people have cyclical theories of history or metaphysical theories or theological theories. And what Smith is putting on the table is a very explicitly economic theory where resource scarcities, the effects of growth, and supply and demand are what are determining long-run historical trends. So running in the background is this very broad methodological and indeed maybe even metaphysical question: what determines or shapes the course of human affairs? And for Smith, economics is going to be playing an overriding role there. One point that Smith stresses early on is simply that in the broader course of history, sometimes prices are higher and they're going up, other times prices are lower and they're going down, and overall there's not some kind of cyclic pattern. The price level really will depend upon forces of supply and demand. For Smith's supply and demand theory of the price level, he sees one factor as of very strong importance, and that is the quantity of precious metals. So, for instance, the price inflation starting in the 16th century, Smith correctly attributes to more precious metals coming from the New World, and you could think of this as an example of more mining. But Smith notes there's a distinction between more mining, which will get you greater price inflation, and also there being a higher quantity of precious metals simply because nations have greater prosperity that will increase the demand for metals and also money. And Smith points out, again correctly, that this will not be inflationary per se. There's a striking passage in the digression where Smith notes that there's been real progress and rising wages for much of Europe, especially Western Europe, but he even notes Russia in this context. But when it comes to the countries of Italy, Spain, and Portugal, Smith strikes a more cautious note. In this section, we also get Smith's clearest statement so far as to where China and what he calls Indostan fit into the broader picture and his general take on global prosperity. Smith notes that many parts of Asia, they're really characterized by having significantly cheaper food, and according to Smith, this is because on a given amount of land, it is easier to grow a lot of rice than it is to grow a lot of wheat. And because of cheaper food, as Smith notes, many parts of Asia are going to be more populous than many parts of Europe. Smith sees many parts of China as having cheaper manufactured goods, precisely because China has so many rivers, and thus there are so many relatively easy means of water transport, and Smith ends up comparing this to Europe, where, according to Smith, too often the goods have to be dragged across long stretches of land. Overall, for Smith, China, at least, is described as being richer than Europe, at least in some aggregate sense. Smith now returns to his underlying question of which relative prices will tend to go up or down over time, and he makes the claim that minerals and precious metals, and metals in general, they tend to grow dearer over time precisely because they're relatively hard to get out of the ground. He asks the question then, well, what else becomes scarcer and thus more expensive with the progress of economic growth? His first example, I find an unusual one, a surprising one, and he cites rare birds. Smith claims that rare birds are difficult to breed in great numbers, and thus, in the course of progress, their relative prices will go up. Smith gives another category of goods where the relative prices go up over time, but I have to confess that here I really didn't understand his argument, even after numerous rereadings, so I'm not sure I can state it correctly. But as I understood it, Smith is saying there are some goods where people are producing them and nature is producing them at the same time, and precisely because people are competing with nature, as progress advances, people will produce fewer of those goods, and thus their relative price will go up. Smith gives the example of cattle. What I don't understand in Smith's account is his understanding of whether or not, even assuming you have a lot of cows out there in nature, is it possible to market those and sell those, and if so, why doesn't that keep downward pressure on the price? Maybe you'll be able to grasp this all better than I can, but in any case, I still find this section in Smith pretty confusing. It's one of those rare instances when I'm reading Smith, and I just can't quite figure out a way of translating the whole thing into modern neoclassical economics or contemporary terminology. Smith gives a third argument for why some goods and services go up in relative price as economic growth proceeds, and this is more straightforward. He says, for some items, supply is simply difficult to augment. He uses cattle again as an example, and here this makes perfect sense to me. Keep in mind, Smith is writing before the age of the refrigerated boxcar, and Smith notes that in a given nation, the market for, say, beef is typically restricted to cattle from the immediate surrounding area. There may be more economic growth, but that doesn't mean it's going to be proportionally easy to breed an equivalent number of cows to satisfy the growing demand for beef. As he's closing up this section, Smith puts a lot of stress on this point. He argues that we really should infer nothing concrete from observing the course of the price of precious metals at any point in time, or indeed over time. Smith is saying this is ruled by supply and demand, and not springing from any overall laws shaping the course of history. And by the way, I know it may seem that these topics are jumping around a bit, but that's the way the digression is written, and it's in those terms that I'm trying to explain it. We now come to the end of the digression on silver per se, and Smith now gives a conclusion to the several varied parts of Book 1, Chapter 11, and that conclusion is pretty straightforward, and it's going to turn out to be very important in the overall history of classical economics and also in the wealth of nations. And that conclusion is simply that with economic growth, land rent will tend to rise. So if we think about Smith's laws of which relative prices tend to go up, well, it's goods and services where the quantity is difficult to augment over time. For Smith, quality land very much falls into that category. Here's how Smith puts it, and I quote, "Every increase in the real wealth of society, every increase in the quantity of useful labor employed within it, tends indirectly to raise the real rent of land." This is a tricky chapter, and its organization is not so transparent, but overall, when we put all the different parts together, we end up at a very significant proposition, namely that with economic growth, the real rent of land tends to rise.